My name is Debbie Robson, and back in 2010, I decided to write a new novel. It would be about a young Australian woman driving an ambulance during World War I. It wouldn't be set in the Western Front. So much had been written about that. It would be set somewhere not so well known, the Eastern Front, or as some called it, the Macedonian Front, a place where no Australian servicemen ever fought. The Dardanelles campaign, although nearby, is not considered part of this front. The Macedonian Front was formed as a result of an attempt by the Allied powers to aid Serbia in the fall of 1915 against the combined attack of Germany, Austria-Hungary and Bulgaria. The Macedonian campaigns did not involve the appalling battle losses suffered by the Allies on the Western Front, nor the tragic futility of the Gallipoli landings, but neither was it the sideshow it was often termed at the time. Much of it was tedious waiting for action against the enemy, and much of it was sporadic but deadly fighting along the Struma and Vardar fronts. But above all, the enemy was malaria. I knew from earlier research that Australian nurses were stationed there, along with British nurses at Lemnos and Salonika. To understand the front, I borrowed The Gardeners of Salonika, The Macedonia Campaign, 1915-1918 by Alan Palmer. Soon after, I discovered mention of a young Australian woman, Olive Kelso King, who drove an ambulance with the Scottish Women's Hospitals in France and Serbia. What were Scottish women doing in Serbia and Greece, of all places, not to mention France? And so my fascination with these marvellous women, these trailblazers, began. But how exactly did the Scottish Women's Hospitals come about? My reading on the subject took me back to the late 19th century in the UK, and in particular to one woman, Elsie Inglis, born in India in 1864. She was not just a leading suffragist, but a facilitator. She quite simply moved mountains and got things done. From her early teens, Elsie wanted to be a doctor, but it wasn't until 1886 when Sophia Jex Blake opened an Edinburgh School of Medicine for women that Inglis began her medical training. As Leah Lenneman writes in her book, In the Service of Life, Dr. Jex Blake was a brilliant teacher, but she was also dictatorial and hedged her students with petty restrictions. In the summer of 1888, some of them rebelled, and when they were told they would not be readmitted because of their insubordination, they brought an action for damages. Elsie Inglis was not one of the instigators of the rebellion, but she ranged herself firmly on their side. And with her father and his influential friends, she helped to found the Scottish Association for the Medical Education for Women, which opened a rival establishment, the Medical College for Women. In August 1892, Inglis became a qualified doctor. By 1894, she was in practice with a fellow student, Dr. Jessie McGregor. In that same year, Edinburgh University opened its medical degrees to women, and Elsie promoted the opening of a hall of residence for them. More details of her achievements can be found in the Lenneman book, but it is suffice to say that by 1909, she was in charge of two hospitals, one of which she founded. She was also, by this time, fully involved in the suffrage movement. Around this time, on the other side of the globe, one of Elsie Inglis's chief medical officers-to-be, Dr. Agnes Bennett, was forging her own path as a doctor in a male-dominated profession. Although forced to give up her medical practice in Darlinghurst Road in Sydney because of the then common prejudices against female doctors, Agnes Bennett was undaunted. She briefly worked at Callan Park and in 1905 took over the practice of a woman doctor in Wellington, New Zealand. In 1915, Bennett became the first female commissioned officer in the British Army, working as a medical officer in war hospitals in Cairo. After a meeting with Elsie Inglis in London in 1916, Bennett began work with the Scottish Women's Hospital, heading up a new unit, the America Unit. I will return to her a little later. When war was declared on the 4th of August 1914, Elsie Inglis initially offered her services to Louisa Anderson, who was forming a field hospital unit, but was told a full team was already assembled. She then went to the War Office and offered her services as a surgeon. She was famously told, "My good lady, go home and sit still." Well, as you may have already guessed, Elsie Inglis wasn't good at sitting still. After much planning, fundraising, and debates over the name, Inglis formed a Scottish Women's Hospitals Committee from members of the Scottish Federation Executive Committee and some personal friends on the 31st of October 1914. Doctors, nurses, drivers and orderlies were recruited through advertisements in the national press. Dr. Alice Hutchison, an Edinburgh graduate of 1903, was chosen to negotiate the establishment of a Scottish Women's Hospital in France. On her arrival in Calais, with Belgian wounded pouring in, her help was requested by a Dr. Depage, and she was given an annex of 50 beds for typhoid work to be done by herself, her assistant and nurses. She was later sent to Serbia. With Dr. Hutchison hard at work in Calais, Inglis went to France to search for a hospital site and ultimately found Royaumont, a medieval abbey. It is an amazing building of pale golden stone with cloisters of soaring arches. The unit there was the largest British voluntary hospital, one of the closest voluntary hospitals to the front line, and the only one to operate continuously from January 1915 to March 1919. In December 1918, 23 members of the Royaumont unit were awarded the Croix de Guerre.
The Croix de Guerre, which in French means war cross, is a French military decoration created in 1915 and 1939 to reward feats of bravery, either by individuals or groups, in the course of the two world wars. This medal may be conferred on any member of the armed forces, on French citizens and foreigners who have been mentioned in army dispatches, and in special cases on military units and towns.
The chief medical officer was Dr. Frances Ivins, and after the war, she was awarded membership of the Legion d'Honour. Keeping track of all the Scottish Women's Hospitals is no mean feat, and I remember during my research that I could never find a coherent list of the hospitals. There was often a disparity in historical accounts and memoirs, with different numbers or names attributed to each field hospital. This is because a lot of the staff worked at various hospitals. As one was disbanded, another was formed, sometimes with some of the same staff. It was only late in my research that I discovered a reliable list, and this is in Evershaw McLaren's A History of the Scottish Women's Hospitals. As it was published in 1919, I had to view the book at the Mitchell Library, Sydney, with a pencil. Luckily, it is now available to view online. 14 hospitals are listed by their location and also by the chief medical officers who ran them. The first two are Calais and Royaumont that I have already touched on. There are 6 hospitals listed for Serbia. The first 4 are numbered units that were all forced to flee Serbia in November 1915. There is also Ranje in southern Serbia and another hospital that served in Serbia late in the war. The other SWH hospitals are one each in Troyes in France, Salonika in Greece, Corsica, Ostrovo in northern Greece, and Russia and Solange in France. Romania is missing from the list, but several field hospitals were established there by the same unit. Dr. Elsie Inglis and the first Serbian unit under Chief Medical Officer Dr. Elena Saltao arrived in Krugovac on the 6th of January 1915. On arrival, they were met by Serbian army authorities and taken to view the hospital before setting up. What follows are some details that I have taken from an account of the arrival of the unit written by William Smith of Aberdeen. Yes, some men who believed in the cause did work for the SWH. Smith was the unit's transport officer. All the SWH units would face similar situations and more, including 2 retreats and imprisonment. But for the moment, this is what the 1st Serbian unit found on arrival. Inside the hospital, I shall never forget the scene of misery, suffering and desolation we found there. One of the largest buildings in the country was full to overflowing. Every inch of space was occupied. It was impossible to pass between the beds, for the poor patients were mostly lying on the floor, some on hay and straw, and others on the bare stone or wooden floors. Sick and wounded lay crowded together, men who had just undergone the amputation of limbs, men in the grip of typhoid, dysentery, or frostbite. Some men dying, some were dead. Many died of sheer neglect alone. The few doctors and nurses were overwhelmed and working day and night against fearful odds and with few or no appliances or medical stores. One surgeon told me that he had been several days without chloroform and even major operations had been carried on without the aid of anaesthetics. The distressing account goes on. The unit was struck dumb with the horror of it all, but set to work, and within a week, the place was transformed. As Smith explained, we had brought everything necessary in the way of equipment, even to bedsteads, blankets, and clothing of all kinds, and were not a little proud of our hospital when everything had been set going. Our patients were both Serbian and Austrian soldiers, friend and enemy, lying side by side, seemingly on excellent terms with each other. The unit had gone out with equipment for 100 beds. They had to take over 250 patients immediately on arrival. The 2nd Serbian unit under Dr. Hutchison sailed on the 21st of April, but was diverted en route. They arrived in Malta on the 27th, expecting to move on after a few days, but the medical authorities there commandeered their help as the first wounded were expected from the Dardanelles. They stayed a fortnight, working in a naval hospital and Valletta Military Hospital. As Alice Hutchison writes, it is lovely to have the chance of looking after our own men for a bit, and I have been thrilled and appalled at the account they give us of the landing of our troops on the peninsula of Gallipoli. On their departure, the unit rushed off without a coffee to catch a train scheduled to depart at 8 a.m, which did not set off until 11. That's when the unit realised that the Greek, like the Serb, has emancipated himself from the tyranny of time. Their destination was Valjevo, 80 miles from Belgrade, where they would remain under Dr. Hutchison until November 1915. Valjevo is described by Margaret Kerr, the cook, as a little town prettily situated among hills on both sides of the river. An antique wooden bridge connects the old part with the modern. The town had been occupied by the Austrians, who had left it in a filthy state, and typhus had been rife, though it was now rapidly disappearing. Of course, the main purpose for a field hospital is to help the sick and the wounded, and in the battlefield, with advancing or retreating armies, the locations of need often changes overnight. The fighting is suddenly elsewhere, or the threat of disease abates. In the spring of 1915, Dr. Inglis had left a surgical hospital in Krugervac with Dr. Lillian Chesney in charge, Dr. Laird with her, and 7 nurses. The rest, with half the equipment and tents, went to Mordanovac, where there was an outbreak of typhus. The hospital at Mordanovac, the 3rd Serbian unit, remained open until November 1915 under CMO Dr. Beatrice McGregor. The administrator there was Mrs. Haverfield, another courageous woman, who was formerly the administrator at Krugervac. Dr. Inglis had to transfer her to the new unit because of a personality clash with Dr. Chesney, who had no time for socialites. Joining Haverfield was an SWH chauffeur, Vera Holm. She was a keen worker for the suffrage and previously was Emmeline Pankhurst's personal chauffeur. In July, the heads of British units in Serbia met at Krugervac to discuss their role in a country where there was no fighting and by then very little disease. Elsie Inglis felt strongly that they should wait in readiness for emergencies, which were bound to come, and at the end of the conference, a resolution was passed that no British unit now in Serbia should leave the country. The general feeling, she reported, was that dull or not dull, it is our duty to stick to our posts. No matter how keen Elsie Inglis was on their units remaining in Serbia, she was just as keen for the SWH to send units elsewhere. The money was still flowing in, and she wondered about a unit for Malta or Alexandria for our own men. By May, there was now another SWH unit in the field. The money to equip it had been raised by the Cambridge Women's Colleges, Girton and Newnham, and it was known as the Girton and Newnham unit. The success of Roermond led the French authorities to request another hospital. But this one was an innovation for France, being under tents. It was located near Troyes, one of the principal stations for receiving wounded from the front, and was a complete unit of 250 beds, the only one in France completely staffed by women. Dr. Laura Sanderman was in charge of medical beds, and Dr. Anne-Louise McElroy in charge of surgical beds. None of the great pushes on the Marne took place during this period, so most of the patients were ill rather than wounded. As with all the SWH units, they organised entertainment for the men. There were songs and tableau, and four of the Scottish orderlies danced a reel. The fourth unit to be established in Serbia was at Lazarevac in August 1915. Dr. Inglis puts Dr. Edith Holway, who liked the Serbs very much, in charge. The hospital was run in various private houses and inns in the town. At the start, they hoped to set up 600 beds. But change was in the air for all the units. The tented camp at Troyes was to be sent east, and the long, peaceful summer was drawing to an end at Roermond, and most dramatically in Serbia. Also working at Troyes was the Australian ambulance driver, Olive Kelso-King. Olive, the daughter of a Sydney company director, was in England staying with her sister when war broke out in 1914. Early in 1915, she joined a small private organisation as a driver, the Allies Field Ambulance Corps, and went to Belgium. She supplied her own large ambulance, an Alder, which would take 16 seated patients. Because of its size, she called it Ella for short. She was not long in Belgium. The organisers of the ambulance corps were suspected by the local authorities of being spies, and they made off in haste, abandoning Olive and two other women drivers. All three were arrested, but managed to establish their innocence and were released just in time to escape the invading German army. They made their way safely back to England. Eventually, all three regained possessions of their ambulances and joined the Scottish Women's Hospitals. Olive's service with the organisation began in May 1915. The unstoppable Mrs. Harley was in charge of transport and was therefore Olive's immediate boss in Troyes until the Germans and Austrians attacked. On the 8th of October 1915, Belgrade fell. All four Serbian SWH hospitals were forced to evacuate. The women were given the chance of going home with the parties who were attempting a trek across the Albanian mountains or staying behind. Both Dr. Inglis and Dr. Hutchison decided to stay along with some of their staff. Part of the reason Dr. Inglis stayed was because she was not going to let the Germans get hold of the medical equipment. They were taken prisoner in November and not repatriated back home until February 1916. The rest, numbering 40, were formed into two parties, one under Mr. William Smith and the other under Dr. McGregor. They joined what became known as the Great Retreat of 1915. It was a harrowing journey, often on foot, over treacherous mountains in snow and later in mud and freezing cold. At one stage, ponies were used to carry supplies. As William Smith relates, ticklish work leading a pony on a dark night down a narrow, icy path, with a high cliff on one side and nothing but a dark abyss on the other, with a rushing river far below. 200,000 soldiers Men, women and children died on the retreat, including some of Elsie's staff who lost their lives in fatal accidents. The women of the Scottish Women's Hospitals involved in the retreat arrived home on the 23rd of December 1915. Whilst all this was happening, the unit at Troyes, France, was to go along with the French Expeditionary Force. The unit itself sailed from Marseille on the 20th of October. Unfortunately, the French arrived too late to help Serbia. When it became clear that the Allies would have to fall back on Salonika, a series of defensive positions were prepared at intervals, and the women were sent briefly to one of these, Gregli in Serbia, before moving on to Salonika. In the summer of 1916 at Salonika, the hospital worked in extreme heat. 1,000 cases, mostly malaria and dysentery, were treated in the months of July and August alone. Two nursing sisters died during the spring and summer, and their deaths had a devastating impact on the morale of the hospital. The hospital would remain there in service until March 1919. By the end of July 1916, Olive had left the Scottish Women's Hospitals and joined the Serbian Army as a driver at Salonika. By this time, the Serbs had lost most of their transport, and Ella was one of only three cars attached to the Serb medical headquarters. When the Gurton unit originally arrived in Salonika, they were not the only SWH unit there. A unit under Dr. Mary Blair had arrived at the end of October 1915. With no access to Serbia, there was uncertainty over their future role, but within weeks it became clear that the hordes of refugees pouring out of Serbia would need medical care. Dr. Blair travelled with the British and Serbian Red Cross heads to some Macedonian towns and saw hundreds of families in dire need. In Salonika, the unit organised themselves to receive, feed and find temporary accommodation for refugees. The French government offered the refugees free transport to Corsica, and it was agreed that the SWH would start a hospital for them on the island. They arrived on Christmas morning. Although the unit continued to serve until April 1919, it experienced a lot of infighting, with disagreements between the chief medical officer and the administrator early in its establishment. Long term, the unit also had more CMOs than any other SWH unit. As we are now more than halfway through the list of hospitals that were established by the Scottish Women's Hospitals, I'd like to touch on the money side of things. Early in the war, Elsie Inglis, along with her colleagues and associates in the suffrage movement, started a massive fundraising campaign that was to run throughout the war. The cause quickly became a popular story in the press. Almost every town and village in Scotland held fetes, coffee mornings and book sales to help raise money. Stirring addresses were given in America, Australia, Canada and India, as well as across Britain. A suffragist called Kathleen Burke was so successful that she became known as the $1,000 a day girl. With the money that Kathleen Burke raised in America, a new SWH unit known as the America Unit was formed. It was a unit that more Australians worked at than any other. As mentioned before, the CMO of the new unit was a 44-year-old Australian woman, Dr. Agnes Bennett. Some members of her staff had already been out with the SWH in Serbia. Doctors Lewis and Scott had been prisoners, and Dr. Muncaster was on the retreat. The unit's sanitary inspector, Annie Gordon, and head cook, Margaret Kerr, had been prisoners, as had the administrator, Florence B. Jack. Another doctor also came from Australia, 55-year-old Lillian Cooper. English-born, she studied at the London School of Medicine for Women. In 1891, she travelled to Brisbane, which became her home. She was tall, brusque, energetic woman, prone to bad language. With Dr. Cooper came her lifelong companion, Mary Josephine Bedford. Travelling out with the America unit was Mrs. Harley's transport unit. Mrs. Harley had been the transport officer at Troyes and decided that an independent motor ambulance unit was desperately needed in Macedonia. Mrs. Harley's transport unit arrived in Salonika about the same time as the America unit, in early September 1916. The push north by the Serbians had begun in mid-1916, and Colonel Sondermajer, Director of Medical Services for the Serbian Army, dispatched both units to Ostrovo, the ambulance column being stationed a few miles from the American unit. When Agnes Bennett arrived in Ostrovo with the bulk of the America unit, she found the preparations far from complete because nearly all of the advance party had succumbed to malaria. Edward Percy Stebbing, who was the America unit's transport officer, had telegraphed to MICRA, telling the unit to delay their departure, but the telegram did not arrive in time. The units had barely settled in when all hell broke loose. Before going to bed that first night in Ostrovo, Dr. Bennett and her staff watched star shells curling into the dark sky and guessed they marked the prelude to an offensive. Early next morning, the silence was shattered by the thunderous boom of artillery. The offensive began. The hospital finally opened on the 19th of September. On the first day, the hospital took 24 cases. By the 25th, they had 160. The hospital was the Serbs' main field and transit hospital, and Dr. Bennett never had an empty bed. During the first 8 weeks, the American unit admitted 523 cases, of whom 60 died. They lost one of their own in October, Olive Smith, the masseuse, from malaria. Regarding the battle, the Gornikivo Ridge formed the foothills of the twin summit of Kamak Chalan, which had to be captured before Monastir could be retaken. The Bulgarians had mountain artillery and observation posts on the summit, but on the 19th of September, the Drina division made it to the top. The Bulgarians counterattacked, and the battle raged until the 30th. E.B. Stebbing wrote, "The Serbs never fought a better fight than when the 3rd Royal Serbian Army, to which we were proud to belong, captured the crest of Kamak Chalan and once again set foot on the beloved soil of their native land." On the 19th of November, a Serbian patrol swam the Krono River and rode triumphantly into Monastir, just ahead of a French cavalry division coming up from the south. Monastir had been won. The Serbs were back on their own soil. But due to a myriad of reasons, including political and strategic, it was to be nearly 2 years before an effective northwards offensive was resumed. In December 1916, Mrs. Harley, after a lot of dissension, resigned from the SWH transport column, which was then merged with the America's Unit ambulance column under the able command of Mary Bedford. Bedford was already known throughout the region as Miss Spare Parts because of her tireless quest for spares so vital for keeping her ambulances going on the terrible roads. Her remarkable success was evident from the fact that during the entire winter, her ambulances were out of action for only 2 days. In the beginning of 1917, an outpost of 30 beds was opened by Dr. Bennett at Dubrovnik. The hospital was moved in April several miles further forward, where they worked till October. Miss Dillon was appointed head of the transport unit, which was to be a separate column again stationed at Yalak. The camp was over 5,000 feet above sea level, with an average gradient of 1 in 8, with narrow hairpin bends. A new driver would return exhausted after one journey, although after a while they would do 2 or 3 journeys in a day. By the time Australian author Miles Franklin arrived at Ostrovo in mid-July to work as a cook, the hospital was well back from the front line. Much of what Miles wrote during or about her time in Macedonia has either been lost or remains in manuscript. SWH personnel were required to sign an undertaking not to write for the press while on service, and only 3 press articles detailing her experiences ever appeared. Ostrovo, a mountain town 90 miles from Salonika, was a place of stunning beauty. The tent hospital was situated under a stand of elms. From the campsite, the mountains to the north were clearly visible, especially the snow-tipped Mount Kamak Chalan. It became emblematic to Miles of all that was splendid to this ancient and very beautiful place. However, it was also an unhealthy place. The staff sick tent was always full, and Drs. Bennett and the second CMO, Australian Dr. Mary DeGaris, both had to leave service in Ostrovo after contracting malaria. Around the time Dr. Bennett was preparing to set up camp at Ostrovo, the London unit, a total of 75 women, with Dr. Elsie Inglis as CMO and Elvina Haverfield as head of the transport column, were leaving Liverpool for Archangel in the north of Russia. At Archangel, they heard their destination was Odessa. On the 21st of September, a magnificent reception was given to the unit. The governor of the town, the British Council, and numerous Russian officials met them at the station. 20 Serb officers lined up to salute them. The unit left for Medicia, the Russian headquarters in the Dobruja district of Romania. Elsie Inglis was given a barrack as a hospital, while 12 members of the unit, plus transport, were sent forward to Bulbulmik to start a field hospital. Very quickly, the fighting moved closer. Ruth Plimsoll, an ambulance driver, had a close call driving a wounded officer and doctor all the way to Chernozavodsk. When the doctor left the ambulance to find out where the patient was to be taken, bombs began to fall on all sides. Ruth remained calmly in her seat, and when the doctor returned and the car moved away, a bomb fell in the exact spot where the ambulance had been waiting. The units were forced to join the general retreat from Dobruja. It was one of confusion beyond all imagination, according to orderly Ethel Moyer. The clamour is deafening. There is the rattle of wheels, the throbbing of motors, the clatter of hooves, the cracking of whips, the curses of the drivers, the groans of the wounded, and nearer, ever nearer, the booming of the guns. The unit members all reached safety, ending up in three different towns. With thousands of wounded men pouring into Brela, Dr. Inglis ordered as many of the unit as possible to come to Brela, while in Ismail, Dr. Chesney opened a small hospital. Hospital A and Hospital B would go on to work in a number of locations in Russia and Romania until the Russian Revolution changed everything. The transport column all but closed down, and Hospital B, by this time in Takasai, was closed down because of constant shelling. The impact of the revolution on the Eastern Front was that the Russians lost interest in the war. Romania, which had joined the Allies in September 1916, was now increasingly isolated. The same fate threatened the Serbian units, which were earmarked to support the Romanians. In August, Elsie Inglis was in Odessa trying to persuade the authorities not to demand a useless sacrifice of the Serbs by sending them back to another debacle in Romania. Luckily, she was not a lone voice. There were many orderlies from well-to-do families who could exert influence in high places back home. Safe passage was granted to take the Serbs from the Russian front to join the main Serb army and the other allied forces in Macedonia. A very sick Elsie, who had been suffering from cancer for some time, could now go home. Back in Salonika, on Saturday, the 18th of August 1917, a devastating fire broke out. Dr. Isabel Emsley, working at the Salonika Hospital, writes, "At 5 o'clock in the afternoon, we noticed a thin lick of yellow flame just beyond the bazaar. By 9 o'clock, huge fireballs were being blown right into our hospital and even beyond it." Olive Kelso King was out in her ambulance transporting people and records to safety, driving for 24 hours at a stretch. Olive was awarded the Serbian Silver Medal for bravery. The fire destroyed 32% of Thessalonica, leaving over 70,000 homeless. Dr. Elsie Inglis finally arrived home in Newcastle, UK on the 23rd of November 1917. She thanked all the Serbian officers on board who had come with her. She died on the 26th of November, and a large crowd attended her funeral service in St. Giles Cathedral, Edinburgh, on the 29th of November, 1917. Exactly 100 years later, the Scottish Government organised a commemoration service at the same cathedral to honour her achievement. A decision was made to open an Elsie Inglis Memorial Hospital in France for Serbian boys suffering tuberculosis. while our own unit would be reconstituted as the LC English unit and join the Serbs in Macedonia. Solange, a small village at the foot of Mont Blanc, is about 13 hours by train from either Paris or Marseille. The Hotel Solange was chosen as the site, and the CMO of the unit was Dr. Matilda McPhail. The first patients were admitted in early March 1918, and the hospital remained open for another year. The LC English unit, under CMO Dr. Annette Benson, was fully staffed. Her second in command was Dr. Lillian Chesney, and the chief transport officer was Geraldine Hedges. The advance party reached Serbliani in the middle of March, and the rest of the unit arrived on the 1st of April. Later, they were busy with cases of malaria and Spanish influenza. The LC English unit remained in service until February 1919. Ostrovo, under Dr. Isabel Emsley, was asked to take a unit to Ranier. All her staff agreed to go. They left Ostrovo on the 23rd of October 1918 for the 193-mile slog over mountain passes on roads crowded with refugees. The hospital at Ranier was the only hospital of any kind for miles around, so they had to cope with not only wounded and sick Serbian soldiers, but the civilian population as well. They stayed open until April 1919. Canteens were also established mainly in France for the French soldiers and also in Salonika. When I was in the thick of all my research into the Scottish Wounds Hospital, I was appalled to find there was no wiki page on the organisation. I created one with the help of Alan Cumming of the UK, who has his own page on the SWH. Just like me, Alan had been inspired by what Elsie Inglis and her 1,500 colleagues achieved. He became involved in numerous events all over the world, spending much of his time promoting the work of the SWH in Serbia, Greece, France, and all over the UK. The highlight for Alan was being asked by the Scottish Government to be their advisor during the centenary year of Dr. Inglis's death, culminating in the event at St. Giles Cathedral. The cathedral was packed to commemorate her life. The attendees included Scotland's First Minister and members of the royal family. According to Dusan Mihajlovic from the British Embassy, Belgrade, members of the SWH are fondly remembered and honoured in Serbia, particularly in those local communities where they had lived, served, and in some cases died. There are schools, streets, and medical centres named after them, and annual memorial services are held across the country. The World War I centenary was a very important occasion to rediscover some of these women and their fascinating stories and to give them the wider national prominence they deserve. In Alan Cumming's words, Dr. Elsie Inglis spent much of her life building bridges, whether for those in poverty or those at the brunt of war, and all the while championed votes for women, an incredible woman who is still building bridges and uniting nations. Thanks.